This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The Iraqi government recently declared victory in Mosul, the stronghold of the Islamic State. Many months of fighting and shelling, with U.S. warplanes relentlessly bombing from overhead, have reduced the once grand and historic city to rubble, while hundreds of thousands of its residents have fled. Despite Iraq's triumphant declarations of having defeated ISIS in the second largest city in the nation, pockets of fighting remain active, and there are reports of 100 or more residents being trapped in the city. The fight against ISIS in Iraq has been used to justify ongoing American involvement in the war-torn nation. Under the Trump administration, that situation is likely to escalate, given the president's bombastic campaign rhetoric. My guest is Phyllis Bennis. She is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, the author of numerous books, including Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, as well as Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. Her latest article in The Nation magazine is entitled Trump's Policy is Clear, Civilian Casualties Don't Matter in the War on Terror. Welcome to the program, Phyllis.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So for those people who hadn't been following the situation in Mosul in particular, especially given that it's getting very little media coverage, how important has Mosul been for ISIS and also for the Iraqi government to prove that it's doing something about ISIS?
Well, I think that Mosul is most important for the hundreds of thousands, indeed millions of people who have lived there for centuries. It's Iraq's second biggest city. It's a historic set of landmarks, some of which, many of which, unfortunately, have now been destroyed. But Mosul is also a largely Sunni city in a predominantly Shia country, Iraq, with a history since the U.S. overthrow of Saddam Hussein in 2003, a history of sectarian Shia-dominated governments, under whose rule Sunnis were not treated very well, to put it mildly. That's the scenario in which the rise of Mosul as an ISIS stronghold emerged. So the symbolism of it for ISIS was very, very important. It was important because it was in Mosul that the leader al-Baghdadi, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, in 2014 first gave the speech announcing the creation of a so-called caliphate, announcing we are now creating something we will call the Islamic State. And it was announced in Mosul, in the historic al-Nuri Mosque, which has now been destroyed. So Mosul became, in Syria, the most important area of the most important area of territorial and population control in Iraq. Its parallel in Syria, of course, is Raqqa, which ISIS then made its official capital. But Mosul remained the most important part of Iraq in this swath of territory that straddled the border between Iraq and Syria that ISIS controlled for some years. Hundreds of thousands of people fled from the city to get out from under the very brutal, violent control by ISIS. And in the last year, the fighting by the Iraqi military, but particularly by the U.S.-backed coalition of airstrikes, has devastated the city. So the fighting, the actions of ISIS, of course, created enormous damage, certainly killed thousands of people. We don't know how many. But it was really the U.S. airstrikes in recent months that have completely devastated, particularly the western half of the city, which is now essentially demolished. It's essentially in ruins. And what has happened since, in what they are now calling the liberation of Mosul, a really ironic term, given that it's appropriate to celebrate the end of ISIS control over people. I mean, they had made people's lives a living hell. But at the same time, the city is now destroyed. Hundreds of thousands, actually millions of people have been displaced. The UN estimates that it will be somewhere over $1 billion just to rebuild the basic infrastructure to provide electricity and water for the city and a few basic buildings, not counting any of the rebuilding of people's homes. The social fabric has been destroyed. The possibility of medical care, the hospitals have been destroyed. And of course, we know that the United States has used white phosphorus bombs in Mosul, as it did and is continuing to do in Raqqa, something that when it's used against highly concentrated population centers of civilians, like in Mosul, is considered a war crime. The U.S. claimed it was doing it to shield the population from being visible by ISIS snipers so they could safely be evacuated. But whenever there is white phosphorus around, no one is safe. No one is safe. It's a deadly, brutal way to die. And we don't even know of the hundreds of bodies that are still lying open, hundreds, maybe thousands more under the ruins, under the rubble of the buildings. We don't know how many of them may have been killed by white phosphorus.
So it's a devastating. In many ways, we might describe Mosul as having been destroyed in order to, quote, save it.
The famous statement from Vietnam, exactly, where a soldier said we had to destroy the village in order to save it. In this case, it's a massive city. And what we're also seeing, and I think this part is particularly important for those of us who live in the United States, when our taxes are going to pay for this devastation, for this destruction, this is looking very much like what the U.S. did to Iraq overall in 2003 as a country, what it did to specific cities like Fallujah in 2004, where the destruction of lives and structure, the infrastructure of the city, historic relics, mosques, all of those things have been so dramatically destroyed in the name of consolidating the victory against the tyrant. Then it was against the pro-Saddam Hussein militias, now it's against ISIS. But the effect on the civilians who live in that city is absolute devastation. So it means we really have to rethink this notion of, once again, of saying that there is a military solution to terrorism. This is one lesson that we should have learned by now. There is no military solution.
And when we put it into perspective, then, if ISIS was oppressing Iraqis in Mosul and killing them, but then the U.S. and Iraqi government destroyed the city to save it, who exactly is then seen as the enemy from the perspective of ordinary Iraqis? And in fact, have more Iraqis in Mosul died at the hands of the U.S. and the Iraqi government than at the hands of ISIS?
I don't think anyone knows at this point how many have died from what. Certainly, huge numbers of people died under the control of ISIS. Some were shot and executed deliberately. Others died for lack of medical care, particularly in the last year or two, where conditions were really seriously deteriorating as the military isolation of the ISIS forces occupying Mosul began to tighten around the city. But with the escalation of the last 9 or 10 months, where you had this massive air war being conducted against the city, the civilian devastation there has been dramatic and devastating. I don't know that we will ever be able to know exactly who's responsible for what. But those of us in this country, we need to take responsibility for what our government did and what it continues to do. What we're looking at here is a situation where you raised one of the key questions, Sonali. What do people who once lived in this city think? Those who are living in these wretched, they're not even really refugee camps yet. The UN hasn't even had time, and they don't have money to establish real camps to care for people, but they're kind of makeshift camps in the desert. The temperatures routinely reach 120 every day. There's very little water, very little food, almost no medical care. And the effect is that people are seeing their prime minister celebrating the so-called liberation, the U.S. saying now the question comes of Mosul is now being returned to Iraqi hands. Well, whose hands exactly? Is it going to be the same sectarian Shia-dominated government in Baghdad that so many Sunnis were oppressed by, when they faced arbitrary arrests, people were being tortured in the jails, the bombing of a nonviolent Sunni protest camp a few years ago? All of these things led many Iraqis, certainly not the majority of Iraqi Sunnis, but many, to look at ISIS as the lesser evil, to see ISIS as at least they would protect our Sunni interests. Of course, it turned out to be wrong. They didn't protect anyone's interests. But it was understandable, I think, why people might have made that choice. The question is now, what's different? We know that the U.S. has claimed, I heard this on a general being interviewed the other day, that we have established, now who the we is, we don't know, we have established a council, a community council to run the city after liberation. And I'm thinking, who picked these people? Is this going to be like the choice of Ahmed Chalabi, the U.S. agent who was supposed to be the new president of Iraq after liberation from Saddam Hussein and ride into town on the back of an Iraqi of a U.S. tank? Is that what we're looking at here again? Who gets to choose? The question of Iraqi Kurds versus Iraqi Arabs, what role will that contradiction play in deciding who will control the city? The Kurds have played by far the leading role militarily in defeating ISIS. Does that mean they are going to claim Mosul as part of Kurdish territory, although it's nowhere near Kurdish territory? None of this is clear. None of this is clear. And the problem is the people who need to be involved in this decision are the ones who have faced ultimate devastation, who have lost family members, who have watched their children go hungry, who are tens of pounds lighter than they should be because they simply have not had enough food to eat, who are dying of treatable diseases because the doctors have either fled or been killed. So we're looking at a devastated population facing enormous emotional and psychological challenges. I assume the entire population of the city is suffering from PTSD. How do you deal with that? 2 million people. That's 2 million people, Sonali, imagine. And what is the U.S. position when Donald Trump says, we're not in the business of nation building. That's not our job. No, our job apparently is just to destroy nations, not to build them.
Right. Well, Phyllis, it seems as though the Iraqi government's role is being used to obscure the U.S. government role in all of this. It's being labeled as Iraq's victory. Not very much news coverage. You know, it should have been headline news over the past week that the U.S. bombing has led to what's happened in Mosul, but that hasn't happened. There was a photojournalist, a war photojournalist named Kinoa Little, who was covering the battles in May in Mosul and couldn't get anybody to buy their photos. And so he published these photos for free online because nobody would buy them from him. What do you make of the skewed or poor media coverage of the story?
It is terribly skewed. I would say that in the last few weeks, there has been, ironically, significantly more coverage of the U.S. role and, in fact, the U.S. primacy. I say it's ironic because it's being touted as somehow a victory, not as a something that the U.S. is responsible for in terms of this devastation. The Atlantic has just published a series of devastating photographs of Mosul in ruins, and some of the mainstream press, the New York Times editorial yesterday or the day before was something like the challenges after Mosul. And it started with celebrating is fine, but let's keep it brief. And then went on to go through all of the challenges ahead, including referencing the impact of the US bombing. It's not enough, certainly, but I think we are seeing more. We're seeing a certain kind of caution among parts of the mainstream press, not all of it by any means, but by some of it. I think looking back to what happened in 2002 and 2003 and the responsibility of the mainstream press for having just drunk the Kool-Aid, if you will, of these lies about weapons of mass destruction and the role that that played in giving George Bush a kind of public credential to go to war in the absence of truth, in the absence of any legal justification, in the absence of anything. So I think there is a certain level of caution. It's not enough. And what we're seeing, as you say, is much more focus on this is an Iraqi victory. But I think that it's also something that we have to recognize is not only a question of what did the U.S. do wrong, but what should a policy look like? And that is much, much harder. It's not enough, in my view, to simply throw up our hands and say, well, ISIS took over. That's not our problem. We must be non-interventionist. the kind of intervention that we need is diplomatic, is economic, is political, is cultural. It's assisting people who are actually functioning on the ground in ways within that society who are trying to fight back against against ISIS, not creating governments that we create, we arm, we pay, and then claim that they are somehow the legitimate right. government.
Which is a pattern we've seen in other countries as well, like in Afghanistan. Phyllis, I want to go back to what you were saying about the treatment of Sunnis under the Mosul leadership pre-ISIS, but also how that might be the framework for reports that we're now hearing about Iraqi troops possibly torturing and killing captured ISIS soldiers in their custody. There are reports, I believe they're still unverified. So are ISIS soldiers being tortured and killed? And are Sunni residents of Mosul being seen as traitors, right?
Yeah, this is one of the huge challenges in a situation like this, where you had ISIS forces who came in from outside, but many of them clearly were Iraqis. Many were foreigners. Those who are left, from what we're hearing now, seem to be more of the foreigners, a higher percentage of foreigners, non-Iraqis. More of the Iraqi ISIS forces have slipped away. They can blend more easily into Iraqi society. There was also, as is the case in any situation of military occupation, some people chose to collaborate with their occupiers, thinking that was a better way to survive. People do it out of survival. Some people may have done it out of ideological affinity. It's hard to know. It's also, in my view, hard to blame people faced with that kind of violence for almost any kind of response. But there is all obviously enormous anger on the part of many Mosul residents who survived, whether they were able to flee earlier or have just now staggered out of the devastated city, just barely surviving and probably having lost many members of their own families. They are very, very angry at those of their neighbors who may have collaborated. So the possibility of revenge attacks, of arrests, torture, etc., is very, very high. It's very, very high. That's an ongoing situation. And I think, you know, we have a similar situation with the Iraqi soldiers who have come in, who have now fought for against ISIS in Mosul, helped to get ISIS out of Mosul. But these were the same, not necessarily the same individuals, but these are the same Iraqi forces who first abandoned Mosul to ISIS in 2014. When ISIS forces stormed in, the Iraqi troops who were there guarding the city essentially put down their weapons and fled, leaving the people of Mosul to the ravages of ISIS. So there's enormous antagonism and anger there as well, particularly because you still have a Shia-dominated military structure in this Sunni-dominated city. So the problems of sectarianism have arisen once again. And the danger, of course, is that that leads in the future to the possibility of leaving open a social environment that could inculcate the next iteration of what's going to come after ISIS. Right. You know, we had Al-Qaeda, now we have ISIS. There could be something else that replaces ISIS later, because people are responding to desperation.
Right, and that kind of violent war never leaves behind a constructive peace. It always makes things worse and leaves behind more chaos, more devastation, from which it's very difficult to recover, as we've seen again in many other situations as well. Phyllis, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest is Phyllis Bennis. She is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, the author of numerous books, including Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. Her latest piece in The Nation magazine is entitled Trump's Policy is Clear, Civilian Casualties Don't Matter in the War on Terror. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.